Welcome to On Spec. This is Ferry Banawa, your host. The notorious Islamic State, better known as ISIS or Daesh in Arabic, isn't dead in Iraq. The Americans hunted for the leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi on October 26 in Idlib, Syria. Baghdadi blew himself up and died before U.S. troops could shoot him in a tunnel. But the terror group stays alive and funds itself in different ways. One is kidnapping and collecting ransom from Iraqis. It's poor people in isolated areas they are taking hostage. Iraqis trying to make a living from truffle picking. In this episode, journalist Pesha Magid, who speaks Arabic, went to Anbar province, where ISIS comes out in the dark. Let's hear her story from there.
I'm in a car driving into the Anbar Desert in Iraq to go hunting for truffles. We had to take three armed vehicles with us on our journey. The reason for the caution is simple. We're hunting for truffles, but we're not the only people out there in the desert. Since the beginning of this year, Daesh, better known as ISIS, has kidnapped at least 44 truffle hunters and killed at least a dozen more. Anbar Desert stretches over a vast area of land that borders Syria, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia. It looks a lot like West Texas. Winter brought heavy rainfall, and this spring, the desert bloomed. The water nourished truffles that grew to the size of cantaloupes. But they grow their biggest in the most isolated and dangerous parts of the desert. Hunting them can cost your life, but they bring necessary income to impoverished rural communities. A kilo of truffles fetches about $5. The customers are Iraqi urbanites, craving the rare desert delicacy. We finally get out at a small village called Mahmoubia, where we meet a truffle hunter named Nafa Sharif, who clambers into the car to show us where he hunts for truffles. Nafa explains that he goes out every morning to hunt for truffles and then comes back. But then when he goes, he needs to take weapons with him because it's dangerous. Daesh is still out there and they still have power. He says that they stay there until the afternoon, around 4 o'clock, and then they leave. Every day, they do the same thing. He says, we need to go out. How can we live? There's no living, so we begin to go out. This sentiment of feeling and economic pressure, it's repeated to me by almost every single truffle hunter I spoke to. We finally arrive to the fields where the truffles grow, and Nafa shows me how you look for them, scraping the ground with a metal rod. This is how you do it, he says, showing me the raised earth that is the telltale sign of a hidden truffle. Daesh is weaker than it's been in a decade. Its kidnapping of truffle hunters is just one of the many ways it's returned to its insurgent roots, acting more like a mafia than a pseudo-state. Nafa makes around $80 from a good haul of truffles. To understand why that's enough for him to risk his life day after day, we have to go back in history a bit.
Baghdad tonight, under heavy bombardment, on the day the war started. American and British troops are in action on land, sea, and in the air.
The American invasion of Iraq in 2003 completely dismantled all systems of government. The one that the Americans tried to build to fill the gap has been marked by one constant: endemic corruption. For over 15 years, Iraq has suffered through occupation, civil war, and insurgencies. While basic services declined, job opportunities vanished, and distrust in the government grew. It's been over 2 years since the last major Iraqi city was liberated, and the root issues of poverty, corruption, and governmental indifference remain the same. Anbar was economically devastated by the war, but it's largely ignored by Baghdad, and its impoverished rural residents remain deeply vulnerable to Daesh.
حكومة ماكو حكومة بالعراق هسه حاليا.
There is no government. Up till now in Iraq there is no government. The government is parties. These parties are just interested in power. The citizens just to stay poor. Many of our people are in the desert.
That's Imad Mutlak speaking. I met him in a village a few hours away from where Nafa hunts for truffles. Like Nafa, he was driven to the desert because there are no job opportunities, and he has a family that relies on him.
طلعنا أني ولد عمي طلعنا نتجنى كما يعني شغل ماكو شغل ضعيف.
I went out with my cousin to hunt for truffles because there is no work, so we go search the desert for truffles. We went about 30 kilometers, ate lunch, looked for truffles. When we were on our way back, a four-wheel car came in front of us. In it, there were two men. They beckoned us over. They came down and asked us to give them our identity cards and our wallets. We gave them to them. First thing they asked was what my work was. I said, I'm a mechanic in Ramadi. They said, we're not looking for Muslims. We're looking for the army and intelligence. We are with Daesh.
Daesh wants to make examples of the people they kidnap. Sunnis generally get ransomed or released, but they execute Shia people and anyone who cooperates with the government. Daesh eventually released Imad because he was from a Sunni area and he was too poor for ransom. He was able to return to his wife and children. In the suburbs of the Shia-majority Najaf, I met with Warda and Haider, the wife and son of a truffle hunter who went to the desert seeking truffles with six of his relatives. For safety reasons, I'm not using their real names.
He called us, said hello, and told us that he will come back tomorrow. He said that, inshallah, on Tuesday, he will come back.
Warda waited to hear from her husband, but as the hours ticked by, she heard nothing.
When they did not come on Tuesday, we tried to call, but his number was closed. We called, but it was closed. And the next morning, we got the news. We tried to call him all day. Even his brother, even his children, their phone were off. All day, even at night, I thought he had run out of battery. The police called our neighbor and took them to the hospital. They were all killed.
They feel abandoned by the government, which years after the fall of Daesh has failed to fully secure the country.
We do not have a state here. We don't have anything, just Daesh. There is nothing else. It's impossible for an Iraqi to kill his brother like that. But for Daesh, it's possible. They kill and kill and kill.
The kidnappings serve multiple purposes for Daesh. They prove the organization still exists, despite its territorial losses. And the ransom money provides a source of income. And by executing Shiites, they seek to sow good old-fashioned sectarian division. Something Haider is bitterly aware of.
Daesh's message is that they are here in Iraq, that they are still here. After 2018, they did not have a victory. They wanted to show Daesh is still here, and the evidence that Daesh is in Naqib between Karbala and Ramadi. They are close to Karbala. Karbala is the second center for Shias after Najaf. They wanted to send us a message. Daesh is the enemy of the people.
Haider remembers his father as someone who tirelessly worked to provide for him, his mother, and his sisters. It was the reason he went to the desert to find the truffles, despite the risks.
والله إنسان طيب وإنسان ما يأذي لواحد.
He was a good person. He was nobody's enemy. He was part of the tribe, a good person who never became anyone's enemy. I never saw a day where he hurt anyone or forced me to do anything. He would work from morning till night. He just wanted us to finish our studies, enter university. The first year I entered university, he was murdered.
Haider studies chemical engineering, but he fears he may have to drop out. The Iraqi state technically guarantees monetary compensation to all Daesh victims, but the process is riddled with corruption and bribery. Haider and his family have gotten no response to their many pleas for help.
If you get our rights from the state, then you'll continue. But if we don't get our rights, I'll have to leave university. But inshallah, I'll be able to finish my studies. We don't have our rights. We don't have any rights.
Like Haider, without truffles, Imad and his family are at a loss. He lives in a dilapidated house lent to him by his cousin. The roof sags and leaks when it rains. He and his wife depend on neighbors' charity for mattresses. They were displaced during the war when Daesh occupied their own home. And after the liberation, it was taken over by a militia. And now they have nowhere left to go. Imad simmers with anger. He hates the state for abandoning them, Daesh for threatening them, and his own helplessness in the face of his family's needs. But he doesn't see a way out.
Where would we go? We think that the blood will never leave us. This area has become embittered. Our area is embittered, my sister.
Imad's wife Aisha says that if it wasn't for the help of their village, she doesn't know how they would survive.
We haven't seen anything since we came here. How long have we been here? We can't even afford to go to a doctor, and even one of my daughters is sick. We don't have money. We just pray to God. What can we do? We don't have anything. My small daughter has been sick for 2 days, but we don't have any money. Thank God our neighbors were able to gather her medicine.
Aisha's words point to the grit of these communities on the outskirts. She and Imad get the basics from their neighbors. The community, not the government, makes sure that his family has enough to eat, somewhere to sleep, and medicine when his daughter gets ill. The state may not be present, but the solidarity of his people are everywhere, from the tea glasses in his hands to the roof over his head. It's not ideal, but somehow or other, these remarkably resilient families keep scraping by. For On Spec, this has been Pesha Magid from Anbar, Iraq.
Welcome back to On Spec, where you'll hear stories that bring you closer to the globe. We just heard Pesha Magid's tragic story from Anbar, Iraq. Pesha, a native New Yorker who's worked in several countries in the Middle East, is based in Iraq. But she recently visited me in Istanbul.
That was heart-wrenching, Pesha. The rural communities are crying for help. Who can they turn to? Is there any international group coming to their aid, since the Iraqi government isn't doing much?
Not in short, not really. There are some international NGOs operating in Iraq, but they mostly don't focus on these type of rural areas. And a lot of them are dealing with intense crisis response, or they're working in the camps for internally displaced people. So in areas like the villages we visited for this story, there's really no international presence at all. Local people are the people who are helping each other. There's a very strong tribal element in Anbar. Tribes basically means, you know, like familial connections and community connections of the people in the area. And the families, they really help each other out a lot, and it's these informal connections that people rely on when they don't have help from international organizations or from the state.
Have you been in touch with the people in this story? How have their lives changed, if at all, since you saw them last?
So not much has changed, sadly, for any of them. They, still living in the same areas, still facing the same issues. Truffle season is over now, and it won't come again till spring next year. So a lot of them, you know, have even less, less resources than they did earlier in the year. But I'm staying in touch with the family of the hunter who was killed. But I'm trying to see whether or not the son will be able to go to university. It's unclear right now. They still haven't gotten compensation.
Is anyone still fighting against ISIS in these rural areas? And who's still part of ISIS? You seem to have more defectors than actual members. Why would you stay with Daesh?
So there have been strong efforts to eliminate Daesh militarily. Local tribal militias play a strong role in that, and they help the military intelligence to find the last pockets of Daesh in the desert. The biggest problem within that is that there are many armed groups pursuing Daesh, and they don't like each other, and they don't communicate with each other, and that does not lead to the best run military operations in the world. There's this group called the PMU, the Popular Mobilization Units, and they're militias that are mostly from the south, but also have a presence in Anbar, especially when they're going after Daesh, and they don't really communicate with the military that well. They don't like each other that much. And so each unit will have their own intelligence that reports back to their own, to their own leaders, but then they won't share that with everybody else.
Pesha, what's it like to travel in Anbar?
Anbar is a diverse place. It's a huge province. And there are parts of the desert that are undeniably dangerous, and a lot of the people who either have to go out there or have to live there are very vulnerable and in a lot of danger because they aren't getting support. At the same time, you go to cities like Ramadi, you even go to cities like Heath, and you'll see a lot of cultural renewal happening. There's new restaurants opening up, there's cultural festivals happening, there's new types of music showing up. And I think that it's important to remember that it's not all bleak. There are people who are really vulnerable who are not getting help, and they need to, their voices need to be heard, and their stories need to be listened to. But I also don't want people listening to this to think that, Iraq is just a dangerous place where, there's only violence and war. That's not true at all. And Anbar, I think, is actually a very good example of that. Anbar is a really diverse and beautiful province in many ways.
How have the foreign powers, such as Iran, the U.S., Saudi, those are the major players affecting what happens in Iraq? What do Iraqis think of them?
They're tired of it. Most Iraqis who I've spoken to do not want those powers to interfere in Iraq anymore. They don't want to be a battleground for foreign powers anymore.
And what are they still doing? Do they have troops on the ground?
So America has several bases in Iraq. In Anbar, they have a big one. Iran, officially, maybe not, but they support many of the militias in Iraq, and they have a very, very strong presence in Iraq. And the particularly between the U.S. and Iran, there is a lot of competition. There's been missiles fired on U.S. bases, missiles fired on bases of Iranian-backed militias. People in Anbar who I spoke to actually were really concerned about this because they're afraid that, if tensions continue to increase, where that violence will bubble over is in their backyard.
And where does Saudi fit in?
Saudi fits in as both, a U.S. ally to a certain extent and a power that dislikes Iran. They don't have historically as powerful a role, but they're trying to assert more influence at this point. They're investing more in Iraq, and I think that they are also hoping to be, one of the new powers that can gather more resources and combat Iran's strength in the region.
Just like Syria and Afghanistan and a lot of these other places, it's sort of a chessboard.
I mean, I think that for Iraqis, like, that's the thing that they really don't want, right? That's the people are very aware of this. It's been years of this. And so people say that a lot, right? They say, you know, other countries are using us like a chessboard and people are pissed off about it. They don't want that anymore.
And they have every right to. The problem is that they don't have a government that protects them against that, right? What can be done to protect these truffle hunters, if anything at all?
So, I mean, the simple answer is that the government can get its shit together, right? But I don't think that's going to happen. And I don't think anyone I've spoken to thinks that's going to happen. You know, like, I think in some ways, very simple things would help, right? A lot of this is about economic privation at the end of the day. It's, you know, they wouldn't have to go out to the desert. They wouldn't have to take these risks if it wasn't for the economic pressure that they're under. And so if the government made more efforts to provide, you know, some sort of aid to people who had their homes and their livelihoods destroyed by ISIS, if they just, you know, worked on providing more jobs, then there wouldn't be as much of an issue. But that's not going to happen. And in the absence of that, I think it's the communities banding together that really is the only thing that helps truffle hunters. It's the neighbors helping neighbors. It's, you know, in Imad's village, for example, the local people, you know, post volunteers up on the roofs to keep an eye out for ISIS maybe coming in from the desert. They put up their own security cameras to make sure that nothing bad is happening. You know, they organize among themselves. And what I've seen in Iraq time and time again is a huge amount of ingenuity and strength from the people, you know, who live, you know, who are protecting their homes, who are protecting themselves and protecting their families and their friends.
You're on your own. It seems to be the message from every corner for Iraqis, and they're doing what they can. Many across the continents think that the American bombs and the Iraqi military got rid of them. But those in Iraq and Syria are saying, nah, not just yet.
Daesh, or its mother organization, Al-Qaeda, was actually in a very similar position in 2010. It was down to its last few men and had almost been eliminated. But then it went underground, hiding in sleeper cells and in isolated areas where the state had almost no control. When it started to come back, it played on the resentments created by the government's almost complete abandonment of the provinces in northern Iraq. And it also just worked like a mafia, offering protection to those who worked with them and intimidating and kidnapping the people who wouldn't. A lot of those tried and true tactics are coming back now as ISIS has been again forced to return to an insurgency. And for a lot of the people in Iraq, they're afraid that the same cycle is just going to repeat itself.
You've met a lot of Iraqis who are suffering from insecurity and poverty, but with other survivors of war, there's a lot of resilience, and still, it's not all gloom and doom, right? Can you tell us about some of the people that kind of inspired you, you know, and how normal life goes on?
He doesn't actually show up in the story, but he is the Mukhtar, or kind of local community leader. And he's a really incredible guy. He was imprisoned by ISIS 8 times, or by Daesh 8 times, during the occupation of his village, but he never left. Many people fled. He refused to leave. He wanted to stay with his community. He somehow managed to talk his way out of prison with Daesh 8 times, which is a feat that very few, sadly, are able to say that they accomplished.
Wow, that's, you know, that's pretty incredible. Daesh or ISIS just kills. They don't listen to reason.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is that they needed to work with him in some way, right? Because he knew everything about that village, and also that the people in that village loved him. And so if they killed him, they would lose access to all the to anything in that village. And they didn't actually have enough people to completely control that village. He said that there were like 3 or 4 people stationed around their village. But he was also a thorn in their side because he hated them. It was very clear that he hated them. He just wasn't going to go anywhere. And I mean, that's one of the reasons that he's an amazing Mukhtar. It's like, you can tell just from speaking to him that he's an incredible talker, right? That he's somebody who knows how to negotiate and also, like, how to keep his position. I mean, I was very, very impressed by him.
And he's introduced you to one of the characters in the story. And tell us, like, what was their interaction like?
So this is kind of how it works when you're doing reporting, especially in rural areas. You kind of have to get to know the Mukhtar first, and then the Mukhtar will take you to, will kind of approve you talking to people in the community. So he knew Imad. He's known Imad forever. And at one point during the story, Imad was talking about how his hair had turned white from all of the stress of this situation because of what he's been dealing with Daesh. And the Mukhtar was like, no, dude, your hair's been white for a while.
Can't blame it on ISIS.
Don't blame this on Daesh. You're just getting old, man.
Yeah. people keep their sense of humors in these parts, and it's a sort of necessary tool for survival. Your story is about a delicacy, truffles, fancy mushrooms, and the people hunting for them despite the dangers. Few know that truffles can even be found in Iraq. What do they look like, and have you eaten them? I mean, how do you cook them?
So they kind of look like potatoes. They look like big potatoes, and they're spongy. And they're also delicious. When Iraqis make them, they're delicious. They're really buttery. They're really rich in flavor. And when I was reporting this story, a fun side of it is that I was able to buy a ton of truffles. So I bought kilos of truffles. And I was so excited. And I brought them all back to Baghdad. And I was going to cook my friends this big truffle dinner. And it was
really— Wow. Okay. You spent all your freelance savings on truffles.
I mean, I'm very wise with my money. So anyway, I made the very wise choice of buying kilos and kilos of truffles, and I asked my Iraqi friends how to make them, and they were like, you know, use this butter, use these spices, but make sure whatever you do, you clean them well. And I was like, don't worry, I got this, I'm a great cook. And so I cleaned them like 3 times, and I thought that was enough, and then I put them in, like, you know, tons and tons of butter, tons of spices. They smelled amazing. Everyone in my house was so excited, was so hungry. There's the wafting scents coming in from the kitchen. And then I bring the truffles out. They look beautiful. They're like glistening in the light.
Wow. And we take a bite. I'm already hungry.
I know. Imagine how we felt. And then we take a bite and they're full of sand from the desert.
Oh, dear.
It was really bad. It was a great, great disappointment. I mean, my heart broken.
But you ate them anyway, right?
We tried to eat them anyway. I tried to struggle through, but they were bad. Like, it was impossible. It was like sandpaper on your tongue.
If you go to Iraq to eat truffles, don't go to a foreigner's house. That's the lesson in all this.
Eat them in Anbar.
At your own risk.
Thanks for bringing us the story, Pesha, and thank you for listening. This is Fariba Nawa, your host for On Spec, where you can hear stories that bring you closer to the globe.
Join us on Spec in 2 weeks, and we'll take you to the tribal territories of Pakistan. This story was edited by me, produced by Oscar Durand, music by Sean Carrier, voiceovers by Alex Tilimpier, Inam Abdulmajid, and Nushin Ayubi. And we'd like to thank those who funded our successful Kickstarter campaign. Here's a shout out to funders Hakan Erdil, Merve Dinchsoy, and Murad Chamcha.